The Theosophical Society in America presents L. Gordon Plummer in a lecture entitled, Is Discipleship Possible in the West?
Any theosophical student, wherever he may be, whether writing or speaking on the subject of discipleship or chelaship, has a twofold duty. He has a duty to his audience and readers, a very solemn one, which entails great responsibility. He also has a duty to the teachers of whom he would speak. And that is also a very solemn responsibility. Because if he errs in presenting the right picture of the teachers, the disciples, the long and arduous pathway that leads to the realization of true discipleship, ultimately to the realization of true adeptship, if he errs in presenting this, then he is influencing minds in such a manner that they will find it more difficult to find the way. And therefore the responsibility is one that cannot be taken lightly. He must speak in utmost sincerity, in utmost honesty, realizing that he is expressing the thoughts that are dear to all of you. He is not putting himself on any kind of a pedestal. He is speaking as one of you, to whom it happens to be the privilege, or for whom it happens to be the opportunity this time to occupy the platform, knowing well that many others have occupied the same platform, knowing well that many others will follow him. But this time, it happens to be his turn to discharge a sublime and a solemn duty. The path of discipleship is a remarkable thing. It is full of contrasts. It is full of paradoxes, full of lights and shadows, and subtle blendings of the two. And we make an effort at a time like this to clarify some of the most important points. It may be said, as H.P. Blavatsky and others have carefully explained it, that it is a very, very difficult path, full of pitfalls, full of trials, full of dangers. That is one side of the picture. The other side is that it is a beautiful path. It is a path of ever-increasing joy, a path of ever-increasing awareness that one is able to make of himself a servant in a sublime work which is the ultimate perfectibility of man by gradual stages of spiritual awakening. And after all, the pathway of discipleship is undertaken with the sole end in view that one can become, one can make of himself a completely willing servant of the human race. And in such service is realized ultimate, complete freedom, spiritual freedom. Now it is my purpose to follow in imagination a student as he treads this pathway. We are attaching no name because such a student could be anybody. It could be anyone at all. and we will follow him from the very point at which we stand now. We will follow him step by step in imagination. We will touch on matters of which we do not have direct knowledge. But it is right that our aspirations and our yearnings for these things should lead us into the higher viewpoint, into those realms where imagination, as a creative force, not as a misguided activity of the mind, not as a misguided wishful thinking, but as a creative force, can lead us to apply some of the principles that we have been taught in our teachings of theosophy, apply them so that we gain some insights into what must be the experiences of those who have gone on. And in this way, we can perhaps achieve a true picture of what discipleship or chelaship really is. And the wonder of it is that it is not something very remote. It is not something that is unattainable. It is attainable to every single sincere student, for the reason that in following the theosophical life, his feet are already on the path. I'm thinking just of a picture where we can imagine ourselves at the seashore. And it is a beautiful afternoon, and the sun is shining on the water. And let us say that we are all on a beautiful beach. And because there are many of us, we stand along the water's edge, perhaps over a distance of a mile or more. And each one of us sees a magnificent pathway of light over the water, reaching to our very feet. We stand at the edge of the water. The sun is low over the horizon. The pathway of light reaches to our feet for each one of us. But each one of us sees that path to his own feet, but the pathway to everyone else's feet is invisible. We may hear that others see it. They may tell us about it, but we do not realize it. Our eyes are on the path to our own feet. And we foolishly think that is the only path that there is. But we walk along the beach, and that pathway follows us, apparently. And we go and stand beside a friend. We discover that our path merges with his. We discover there never was any difference. And perhaps two or three others come and join us. And that pathway is one. And we discover that if we had universal vision, we would see that while the sun is one, the pathway appears to be many. Had we the universal vision, we would see not only all of the pathways at one and the same time, but we would discover the whole surface of the ocean is covered with light. Now, thus it is that H.P. Blavatsky said in her beautiful treatise, The Voice of the Silence, the way is one. The pathway must vary with the pilgrim. We discover in the real meaning of this that it is not a matter of many interpretations of the teachings. It does not mean that. It means that each one is the path. And the reason that there are many pathways seemingly is that there are many wayfarers. There are many disciples. Each one of us is actually his own pathway. Now this pathway, because it is a pathway of light, it is a pathway of illumination, carries with it ineffable beauty, ineffable richness of spiritual vision. But there again is the paradox. It is also a pathway of training. It is a pathway of discipline. And one of the very first things that we must do, if we ever hope to really see this pathway at our feet, is to dispel all sense of glamour over this teaching of discipleship. As long as we see a glamour around it, we do not see the path. We see only the glamour. And in the early days of the Theosophical Society, more so than at the present time, the fact that letters were being received by either the hand of the masters themselves or through their amanuensis, H.P. Blavatsky, there was a kind of a fevered excitement in the society concerning the adepts. It was believed quite erroneously that the Theosophical Society was founded as a kind of a nursery school for budding chelas. Such was never the intent at all. It was a society for the promulgation of the teachings of the ancient wisdom, for the founding of practical brotherhood. And those facts were lost sight of in the mad clamor for special favors, for special admission into the Temple of Divine Wisdom. And many who sought admission in this way lost sight of the real purposes of the Theosophical Society as the instrument of the Theosophical movement. They had little understanding, if any, of the Theosophical movement. And many of them believed that they were fitted and ready. And because some of them were sincere in this belief, because of this, some of them were tried. They were tested. And then the difficulties became very, very apparent. And we sometimes think that the Mahatmans, the masters, so-called, the spiritual teachers of the race, are very remote, very, very impersonal, and it is true, they are impersonal in the higher sense of the word. But we sometimes forget that they are humans, and that they are capable of human feeling, the highest feelings of human compassion and understanding. We can only imagine, but we cannot know, the deep, the keen disappointment that they must have felt in the failures. We cannot help but at least imagine and feel for them and understand why the lesson that was learned was a deep and a bitter one. And we can understand why, because of the results of fools rushing in where angels would fear to tread, we can understand why they are so reluctant to make themselves known. We can understand why they issued such stern, such serious warnings. We can understand why they want to spare the aspirants the deep frustrations of failure. But now let us imagine that we can follow the footsteps of one who makes the grade. The failures have occurred. The warnings are as applicable today as they ever were. But so also is the possibility of success as real today as it ever was. And while in the early days the Mahatmans seemed to be closer by reason of the sending of the letters and by reason of the possibility of Sinet preeminently, but others as well, communicating with them, and they seemed to have withdrawn, the fact remains, it is just as possible today for a fully qualified aspirant to realize the full richness of the Chela life as it ever has been. Therefore, we are right in following, in imagination, the footsteps of one who, let us suppose, makes the grade. Let us imagine him as a person as you and I, who has certain yearnings, certain longings to be something better than his ordinary everyday self. In studying himself, in studying his reactions to people, to the situations that life brings, he realizes that there is much lacking in himself. He realizes that there is a great need for self-improvement. This realization which comes to him is a very healthy sign, and it is the beginning of a work of self-improvement, a beginning of a work which is arduous, which will take him many, many years, and attached to which there is no glamour at all. It is hard work, this business of self-improvement, this business of eradicating from his thoughts the selfish tendencies, the tendencies to strike back, the tendencies to get even with someone who has injured him. All of this is hard work. It is work in which he will find very little competition. He stands alone. And that is one of the first tests. He must learn to stand alone. He learns that every step of the way will be taken by himself and himself alone. He learns, however, that deep satisfactions come with doing his work well, with learning to live in harmony with his associates, with discovering that people in trouble turn to him for advice. He learns the skills that come with giving helpful suggestions. He learns that he can do it. And when he finds that people are helped and aided by his advice when they come to him, he doesn't interfere with people. He doesn't push himself on them. But he is ready to give help and counsel whenever they come. He discovers that there are feelings of deep satisfaction because they have looks of gratitude on their faces. And when he can give an insight to some person who is searching, and when he sees in the eyes of a fellow being a look which says, "Now I understand," that is a great reward for him. That is a reward greater than any he has ever known. He feels that he is approaching the time when he can be of real practical help. His interests widen. And because this is so, he finds that in religion, in science, in philosophy, there is much that holds his attention, that appeals to his imagination. There is much that attracts him. He reads more widely. He studies. He is interested in what other people have written, what other people say. And he finds that in following their thinking, he can do some original thinking of his own. Sooner or later, let us say, books on theosophy come to his notice. And we are going to follow this imaginary pathway through his interest in the teachings of theosophy for the simple reason that in these teachings, his inner being finds the nourishment that it seeks, the nourishment by which it grows stronger. When people sometimes ask, "What is the practical value of the theosophical teachings? What good does it really to know about the rounds and the races, about the seven principles of man, about past civilizations? What good does it really do to know about the sacred planets, the planes of consciousness?" The obvious And the compelling answer is that in these teachings, the higher self of man finds the nourishment that it seeks, the nourishment that it needs, whereby it can grow. These teachings provide for us the means of growth. There is their ultimate practicality. So it is right that to this wayfarer should come the teachings of theosophy in books. By means of study groups, he is invited to groups of people with like interests. He attends meetings. Little by little, he may discover, perhaps somewhat due to his dismay, but this is a necessary stage in his growth. He will discover that, as in all things, there are good books, there are bad books, there are books not so good. He must learn to separate the chaff from the wheat, and his natural inclinations, his natural desire to serve, his natural desire to be as the teachers are of whom he studies, this in itself is an aid to him in sorting out the chaff from the wheat. He absorbs the nourishment of the wheat, and he yearns finally to do practical theosophical work. He yearns to master the teachings to the degree that he can write. And he knows that in writing, he is going to touch the hearts and minds of fellow theosophists. He yearns to speak. He yearns to equip himself to give the teachings in the best possible manner, because he realizes that in this simple act of explaining the teachings, he assumes a tremendous responsibility. He is affecting the minds of all of his listeners. Perhaps he is changing the life of someone who comes in an hour of need. Perhaps the change is one which is going to affect a fellow student, not only through the years of this life, but for lifetimes to come. The responsibilities undertaken by anyone who would teach theosophy are great indeed. And it behooves us to think of these responsibilities many, many times. And so, in his desire to teach, he discovers there is no way to learn so rapidly as to teach. And if we have the desire to teach, the ability to assimilate the teachings grows to a degree never before realized. And so, as we follow him in imagination, we are reaching the point, perhaps, when we are going to say, he is moving beyond those experiences of which we are capable, but it is right that we should go out in thought and in imagination. We should follow him, because in awakening our own aspirations, we are doing exactly the right thing. It is what is appropriate. It is what is desired, because the teachers themselves welcome our aspirations. They look for them. And so we follow him to the point where his desire for more light takes on a new form. It takes on a form of asking for more light. And in some of the most sublime and mystical words of the Bible, he discovers a key, a new meaning, which is a clear directive to him. These words are, ask, and it shall be given to you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. Those are perhaps the most potent words in the Bible. For any true aspirant, they are filled with occult meaning. What does it mean to ask? What does it mean to seek? What does it mean to find? How can we seek unless we have some idea of that for which we seek? Are we asked to seek blindly? Are we asked to take on to ourselves a completely blind faith? To stake everything on the cast of a die to either win or lose according to the number that may come up? Not at all. The knowledge of what we seek is in the teachings. The power to seek is there. The daring to seek is with the aspirant. He knows that for which he seeks. He seeks the priceless treasure of the ancient wisdom. He learns to ask, but he must ask in a voice that will be heard. A voice tinged with the personal desire for knowledge for the sake of the power that it will bring is a voice that will never be heard. He may shout it aloud, but it will never be heard. The voice that will be heard is an unselfish call for more light only to the end that he may share that light with others, only to the end that he may light the pathway for those less fortunate than he. That is the only call that will ever be heard, and that call will be answered immediately. It is sometimes thought that in the stern warnings given about the dangers of chelaship, the awesome, the terrifying pathway of chelaship, it is sometimes thought that these warnings are given to prevent anyone from undertaking the pathway. That is not so. They are given to prevent all those who are not ready. And it is only in their own interest, in their own behalf, because it is a terrible thing to undertake the pathway if we are not ready. It is a terrible thing, because it is, as H.P. Blavatsky said, echoing the words of the teachers, a psychic resolvent. It is like a melting of the gold in the crucible of trial. And only when the student can stand the melting heat, so that the gold is reduced to molten metal, that the dross may arise. And if in a nature there is more dross than gold, success is impossible. And it is for these that the warning is given. The warning is not for those who are qualified. For those who are ready, the call is, come up higher. Come to us. That is the call. I'm reminded of a story. It is a fairy story, to be true. I don't even remember just where I heard it. But it is the story of a knight who seeks the hand of the princess who is in a castle. And he goes with his sword drawn, in full armor. He fights the guardians at the gate. Perhaps he slays them. And he stands before the gate. And the princess, as I remember it, does not open the gate. But she calls out to him. When the right one comes, he doesn't have to fight his way. I come and open the door. And there's a world of meaning in this story. And so, in our imagination, we are following one who knows how to give the right knock. The right knock is a self-dedication to the service of humanity, complete and utter dedication of himself, so that he lives, he breathes, he thinks for humanity alone. That is the knock that will never and can never be denied. Never has it been denied. Because, as H.P. Blavatsky said, and after all, her voice of the silence consists of rules for aspirants. When the disciple is ready, the teacher is ready also. And so in our imagination then, we are privileged to follow him as he proceeds. He gives the knock. He discovers there are others like himself who have dedicated themselves to service. And he understands then the knowledge has been growing with him. He understands what chelaship actually is. And let us never think that he enters into a sort of a happy summer land where all is bliss, where all is happy smiles, and where there's much handshaking and embracing. There is absolutely nothing of mawkish sentimentality in the experiences that lie ahead for him. If there has been trial for him in the future, if there has been testing in his life, whereby he thinks he is tested to the ultimate degree that he can stand, that is simple compared to what lies ahead. For him now, there is the road of ultimate service to the human race, filled with trials, filled with work, hard work. For the life of the disciple is a stern life. At the same time, it is a life of unutterable beauty. This is what he learns. He learns that in his right to know the deeper teachings, the occult language consists of letters. There is, as it were, the letters of the occult alphabet. And just as a child must learn his letters before he can speak, he must learn his words before he can put them together in intelligible sentences, and before he can express himself in understandable paragraphs, if he's writing, and pages. So, our disciple, our imagination, carries us to the point where the disciple learns the letters of the occult language. He learns the deepest teachings that he has ever known before, teachings that it is not appropriate for him to share, but we can imagine what they must be like. Some of them perhaps involve some of the mysteries of death, some of the mysteries of genuine initiation, some of the mysteries concerning his own inner nature, where he realizes his oneness with the universe. He realizes the ultimate relationship that exists between himself and the planets of the solar system, the planes of consciousness, that these relationships exist because he is part and parcel of them. If there is a portion of himself, let us say, that is related mystically and occultly to the planet Venus, he learns it is so because it is a portion of the divine intelligence of the planetary being that manifests through that orb we call Venus. Now, this is merely a hint of some of the things that he learns. He learns the reason why. All of this knowledge is merely the letters of the occult alphabet. As a disciple, as a chela, he learns the letters. He does not acquire the power to put the letters together into intelligible words and sentences. That power comes only when he has crossed that mystical, that awful bridge, awful in the sense of meaning full of awe, that awful bridge of initiation. One of the great tragedies of the theosophical work is that the word initiation has been used so widely, so freely, so easily, and so little has been known about it. Initiation is one of the most marvelous things that can happen to any human being, and yet one of the most difficult things that can ever be achieved. And I would like to give an illustration as I saw it once in the simple blooming of a plant. And I've used this illustration before. It is one that had such meaning for me that undoubtedly I will speak of it many times. At home, we have a night blooming cereus. And it is a plant that blooms but one night of the year. Through most of the year, Its leaves are of a rather uninteresting olive gray, sometimes splotched with brown and yellow. Not a particularly lovely plant to look at through most of the year. But that plant is biding its time. It is waiting for the warm summer evenings and ours blooms in the month of August, and for many days, perhaps several weeks it was, four buds appeared. They were very small. They took their time to grow. We wondered, would that night ever come when those buds would open? They were so nearly opened that we would think, this must be the night. But it wasn't. We had yet to wait another night and another and another. One night it happened. And those blooms that appeared were of such a heavenly purity and radiance. We called our neighbors in to see. The air was filled with the perfume for the one night. And I could not help but be impressed with the lesson. Out of this unlovely thing, from it and from nowhere else, came the beautiful blossoms. Out of it came the heavenly blossom of the night blooming Sirius. And I could not help but realize that as we are in this early stage of our growth, we are like this night blooming Sirius. Unlovely to look at. We have so many faults, so many failings, so much that we have to work through before even the bud appears. But the bud does appear in time, with the assimilations of the lessons of life, with the growth that comes with suffering and experience, with the assimilation of the teachings of the esoteric philosophy, with the assimilation of the atmosphere of those teachings, the nourishment that we receive, the bud does finally appear. And from ourselves shall come in time the blossom. And it will amaze anybody to know, to think ahead. It would amaze any one of us to know of what we are really capable. We do not even guess of what we are really capable of achieving, of what we can really produce when the time comes. And it is like this plant. Who could guess, had he never seen this before, who could guess the hidden beauty of that flower all through the months when it was a rather unlovely thing to look at? Who can guess what any one of us is capable of in time? But it is the stern, the difficult training of discipleship that eventually brings it about. And when all the dross is finally cleared away and only the gold remains, then perhaps he is ready, the one that we are following in imagination. He is ready at last for the supreme adventure of initiation. Then and then only does the flower open. Then and then only has he the power that he yearns for to put the letters together. The letters that he has learned in assimilating the teachings, he can put them together. He can form words. He can form sentences. He can teach. In other words, he is then a teacher, and not until then. He is an adept in the true sense of the word. He is adept at the skill of awakening human hearts and human minds to the sublime teachings. Now, sometimes we hear people say, and they say it quite seriously, oh, that is not for me. Oh, it'll be thousands of incarnations before I'm ready for anything like that. I'm completely and utterly unworthy. May I say, from what I myself believe, that if the teachers were to hear anyone say that, they would have absolutely no patience with it whatsoever. That is the thought that holds us back. That is the unworthy feeling that stunts our growth. We are worthy to do our part as we stand today. Let us hold our heads high, being proud of the fact that we are theosophical students, that we do have the priceless privilege that was given to us by H.P. Blavatsky. In the Sanskrit words, iti maya shrutam, thus have I heard. She merely gave the message faithfully as it was given to her. She claimed nothing for herself beyond the priceless privilege of giving the teachings. Now that is what we owe to her. That is the example that we are charged to follow. It is a sacred trust given to us, and we are right in examining ourselves and asking, are we discharging our duty as it has been given to us? Are we faithful to the trust? And may I close with just one illustration, because I think sometimes that giving illustrations and word pictures are the most graphic way of getting a point across, better perhaps than a half hour of discussion. And it will answer the question perhaps that is in some of our minds, is our work known in the right quarter? Perhaps we work hard, we labor for years and years, we have no evidence that our work is really known. We do the best we can. Do we know really if we're working in the right way? So here is the illustration I would like to give you. Imagine that you are walking on a hillside, a high mountain top, climbing one of these hills. And let us say that we are away from the town where the stores are not so busy and the gas stations and so forth. We're away from that. We're out on a more lonely, remote hillside. We look out over the trees, the chaparral. We do not see people. We do not see the houses. We think perhaps we are completely deserted. Now let us say we have been there throughout the long day, throughout the long afternoon. Night has fallen. People turn on the lights in their houses. We do not have to look. Those little dots of light here and there all over the countryside attract our attention. We look over there because we can't help it. They attract our attention.
The talk by Mr. Plummer ends here.